talked about different levels of regulation that we're going to run into as people in the construction profession. And the federal government, of course, is they're kind of the big dog in the whole thing. Today what we're going to focus on is really this aspect of civil rights that affects construction.
And of course, the Americans with Disabilities Act is particularly appropriate for the design communities, architects, industrial designers, interior designers, even web design. Even web pages have to be accessible these days. So it's not just about construction. Construction professionals need to know about it in order to make sure they maintain access to new and existing facilities while they're under construction, wherever access by the public is required.
You wouldn't normally think of civil rights affecting construction except through hiring practices, but the Americans with Disabilities Act got elevated really to a point where access to the physical environment, kind of anywhere, anytime, anyhow, is now, it is a civil right. So violating that willfully is kind of willful violation of someone's civil rights, which usually ends up in court. And there's kind of a law that is a little bit of a surprise to a lot of developers, some design builders in housing, called the Fair Housing Act, and I'll tell you a little bit about that too and how it might impact what you do. So this civil right it's not enforced by OSHA, the Americans with Disability Act or Fair Housing. It's not enforced by NIOSH. Those are the people that are worried about your health and safety in the workplace. It's enforced by the Department of Justice. So kind of violations of the ADA. Who's the Attorney General? So if this fellow Gonzalez knocks on your door, he's the Attorney General and you're in deep weeds. Generally speaking, there's only been a couple of high-profile cases brought by the Department of Justice against design builders. And mostly the most recent ones were about the new sports stadiums. I think it was either LRB Sports or HOK Sports, the people who build football and baseball stadiums, got taken to court by the Department of Justice. While they designed the stadiums to be accessible, they didn't design it so that if you were in a wheelchair, you could see over the crowd that was standing up. So they didn't control their sight lines well enough. And they came to an agreement with the Department of Justice that they would make certain retrofits to some of the stadiums and they wouldn't keep doing it. I'd say if you're a single builder, people aren't going to come after you. But it's kind of it's an ethical or a moral decision to make sure that the things you build can be used by pretty much everybody. Of course, I've got a vested interest in this because I'm on my way to being not fully physically functional. You know, my eyes are going, my ears are going, my legs are getting a little stiff, and my hands are kind of getting arthritic now. So all of those aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act, me and almost everybody else my age, has a real interest in making sure the environment stays accessible to us. In the early 1970s, the building code started requiring that toilets have grab bars in them and buildings have ramps going up to them. But because they were in the building code, it meant that a local building official could say, no, I'll write you an exception. And the federal government was seeing that really no progress was being made. The advocate group that was really pushing for full access to the environment was, it really wasn't the American Association of Retired People. It was the Paralyzed Veterans of America. They were the ones that were saying, hey, you know, we're coming back from Vietnam. We're coming back from Korea. We did our service. All we want to do is be able to get into the place where we work. We want to get into the place where we worship, and we want to be able to take our family out to dinner every once in a while. It's not a lot to ask. And the government said, yeah, you're right, we got to take it out of local control, and we've got to elevate it. Their first step of elevating that set of accessibility concerns was the Fair Housing Act. So really, since 1988, the government has said, even though there's no federal money in it, you can't discriminate against renting to someone who has a physical disability. So everybody has to be able to get in. So if I do a 20-unit apartment, a few of those units are going to have to be designed and built to be fully accessible. So they're going to have a little bigger toilet than usual. They're going to have the kitchen where maybe the countertops can move up and down. They're going to have front controls on the range, front controls on the washer dryer, and all the doors in the apartment will have to be 3-0. But then they're saying, now another percentage of what you build has to be convertible. So if I have ground level access for 12 apartments, maybe only two of them in that 20-plex would have to be fully accessible. But the other ones, maybe another four or six of those, would have to be convertible. So I'd have to already have grade level access or ramp access to the units, and I'd have to have at least as a minimum 3-0 doors to everything. What's the standard door width like to a bathroom? Yeah, it can be down to 24 inches. It can be pretty skinny, and closets too. And what they're saying is just start thinking everything is 3-0. The difference between a 2-foot-4 door or 24-inch door and a 3-0 door cost-wise, it isn't that huge. So they're saying make a certain percentage convertible. This surprises a lot of people when they get to when they get out in the market. I've had calls from architects who call me up and they're mad at me. You know, they're saying, "Why is the federal government impinging on my right to develop this 12-plex?" And it takes a little while, and you finally find out that basically a renter had come to them, and they said, "Well." The renter said, I need you to make certain adaptations so that I can get into the building and so I can rent an apartment. And the architect who owned the building, who developed the building, said, sorry, I can't do that. And the renter turned around and went to the local Department of Housing and Urban Development and said, this landlord's discriminating against me. And they were right. And ultimately, they had to make one apartment accessible, because they hadn't anticipated it in the design and construction stage. So this is changing. Anything with four or more units in it has to be designed and built to allow access for a person with disabilities. This Jefferson, what is it called? Jefferson Street condos or whatever it is on Main Street down here, the elevated one. That one was going up, and of course all the apartments are up one level, right? Because it was stores on the first floor and parking on the first floor. They were held up for about 6 months because somebody flagged it and said, wait a second, how is a person with a disability going to get up to that next floor? And they had to retrofit an elevator into the design as they built their secondary phases. So it's a real thing, and we have to just be aware of it. Because if you can account for this stuff at the design, you know, when you have to correct something on paper, it maybe cost you $100 to affect the change. If you have to correct it while it's in kind of your shop drawing review, it might cost you $1,000 to get the change made. But as soon as you get on the job site, that same dollar change might be $10,000. So it seems to jump up by a big factor as you let the error progress through the system. But Congress went a little farther. In the middle 1990s, they said, no, this has got to become a civil right. Everybody gets to go to work. Everybody gets to go to wherever they worship. And everybody gets to go out to Outback and have a, what is the thing? The big onion that makes heart attack on a plate. Everybody gets to have one of those things. So it becomes a civil right. So we have to make sure that everything that gets built, people can get into. It's pretty straightforward though, because this is really just good design. You know, if you have a parent with a stroller, they're going to really like this because they can get into that business. They can get into that store, or that library, or whatever. If you have somebody that's carrying too much junk, like, you know, I'm almost always carrying two armloads of stuff, and I get to the front door.
And at this point, I'm going to gesture at a lever handle door latch because I've got round handle door latches on my house.
And I don't have one of these on my front door. I have one of these on my front door. If I have this on my front door, I go like this. And I don't have to put down, you know, all my Diet Pepsi and my chips. Otherwise, I could put the chips down, then the cat comes and jumps on the chips. I can't make nachos, and then I'm really upset. So new construction has to comply. Actually, existing construction has to be brought into compliance as well. So a big institution like Virginia Tech, they're kind of a prime focus area for the Department of Justice. And what they've asked Virginia Tech to do was they said, we know you can't fix it all tomorrow. So what we need is we need a 5 and a 10-year plan that says we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, and by this year we're going to be fully accessible. And then all they want is they want that institution or that big company to just show good faith effort towards meeting those goals. So Virginia Tech has done that. You know, they went through and they took out all their curbs at the sidewalk ends and put a ramp in so you can get from the sidewalk down across the street. They did that pretty well. They went into a lot of the buildings and immediately they built a bunch of plywood ramps. But then they came back 5 years later and they made elevator lifts into Burris Hall and into Sandy Hall and into the architecture annex. So they're really working at it. They're making a good faith effort, and that's really all the government wants.
Back to like the individual houses. If you're building like a townhouse community for rent,
yeah,
do they have to make like a stairwell in each or in at least one unit like wheelchair accessible?
It may be. It may be that there are some that you'd have to make that. I think there's a number threshold that you have. Once you cross that number threshold, you're looking at making some units accessible. Usually they make a different model. They'll make an all one floor model and they'll make a walk-up model on top of it. Usually that's what happens. I can dig for that. I think actually part of it is in the ICC now. The percentage of those things. I'm pretty sure it's in the International Building Code now. So I'll get you those numbers. I think it's a percentage break. So unlike any other thing that can be exempted, you know, because if we have a zoning question, who do we go to get a zoning exemption from? This is your warm-up for the test. Zoning and planning, and it's called the Board of Zoning Appeals. The BZA. If we have a code problem and we need to get an exemption, who do we go to? We start with the building official. But this, there really isn't an exemption to the Americans with Disabilities Act. I imagine the president could give you an exemption. I think it would be pretty hard to get, though. Basically, though, what designers are doing is they're just approaching this as the question of universal design. They say it's actually better for everybody. So it's better for us to be able to walk into a restroom and not necessarily have lever handles on the faucet, but have it so we just put our hands under the faucet and the water comes out. Because then we don't have to touch it, and when bird flu finally gets here, we won't spread it quite so quickly, right? The same is true when I'm at the airport and I've got all my bags and stuff and I need to use the bathroom. I like that big stall because I can get all my bags in that big stall with me so they don't disappear while I'm in the toilet stall. I mean, I kind of like as a parent when I had my kids in the stroller, I could get into the building going upstairs with the stroller. It's not impossible, but it's really kind of tricky. And I'm a person that it's not good. And I don't recommend it to you, but I read books when I walk. I find it comforting. I don't know why. And the ADA basically says when a sidewalk approaches a street, you got to change the texture you got to change the color. And that color and texture change has been enough that kept me from getting smacked by a Blacksburg transit bus as I approached the street. So it's kind of good for everybody. And I'd say in the class, our class so far, I've seen three or four people with either crutches or kind of a brace on their ankle from injuries so far this year. I mean, all of us are just one misstep away from actually being able to use all this stuff. It makes life a little easier, just a little easier. The other critical aspect of this is all the facilities have to be usable without a loss of dignity. So it doesn't count if you say, well, you can go around the loading dock, and the loading dock has an adjustable plate, and we'll just lower the plate down, you go in. No, you got to be able to go where everybody else goes. If everybody else goes in the front door of Outback, you got to be able to go in the front door of Outback. I used to give when I taught this to architects, I'd give them a project. I'd say, now form up in teams of five, and I'd say, now this group of five, start in the classroom here, and go over to the graduate school and just get some brochures, and then come back. And I'd give another group, I'd say, go to the bookstore and buy a bag of potato chips or a candy bar. And can you do that? Sounds pretty simple, right? All of us could do that. But if I said you had to do it in a wheelchair, can you buy a candy bar at the bookstore on campus? No, because it's at half level, right? There's no way to get to it. So if you need that, you really need that chocolate. You know, like 3 o'clock, I really need that chocolate. You got to wheel up to the edge and you got to shout over the edge, "Hello, can someone get me a Hershey's bar?" And then they're gonna bring one to you that's got almonds in it. No almonds. They'll go back and they'll bring you one. You go, "Oh no, I wanted the one that was white chocolate with the Oreo crunch in it." But that kind of imposition is, you know, kind of the measure of did you breach dignity or not. People want to be able to take care of themselves, just like everybody. And whether you're in a wheelchair or whether you're not, you should be able to live your life. And I guess one of the reasons, you know, I bring this up and ask you to pay attention to it is, as builders, you know, you're the people who get to make suggestions about tweaks to the building. Sometimes there's suggestions that are just going to make it easier to get the paving in, or easier to get the grading done, or maybe we'll save the owner some money. But ultimately, you've got to think of this as well. So when a project gets to the point where the only possible answer to getting in is you got to go around the side of the back of the building, if that's what your designer's proposing, you got to ask them to start over. Because it's not acceptable to make one group of people go in the back door and make another group of people go in the front door. It just doesn't work. And the question I always ask myself is, would I be comfortable asking my mom to do this? For me, I asked this question because my mom lost her leg to cancer when I was 16. At that time, the world wasn't accessible, and she just quit. She gave up. She did not leave the house, literally, for 15 years until finally we said, you know, the world is a little different, Mom. Outback is fully accessible. They want you to come there for dinner. And it was like, you know, discovering America for her. Like, you mean I could go shopping? Yes, you can go shopping. I can go to church? Yes, you can go to church. But prior to that, she couldn't get anywhere, you know, because she'd have to go there, sit at the bottom of the steps, and wait for six burly people to come up and say, "Could we carry you up the steps?" And then they're carrying her up the steps, and she's like some sultan in a sedan chair, you know, entering the building. And she doesn't want that kind of attention, right? Because she feels freaked out because she isn't the same as everyone else. So that's my measure. If I can't get my mom in there on her own, then I didn't do it right. And if your designers don't do that for you, call them on it.
I was going to ask, so is the designer and architect?
They are primary. And it's up to us to follow through with the details. And that's why I'm talking to you about this stuff today, because the details are where usually it fails. All this stuff was developed primarily from the Paralyzed Veterans of America. So these are a group of people who have really good upper body conditioning. And the standards that are out there today assume that. They assume that you can basically do a push-up on grab bars. And as that whole veterans community ages, you know, we're finding that a lot of these standards don't work so well anymore, because these guys don't have that upper body strength at age 80 that they had at age 45. So there's a lot of research going into this. Now, the ADA also includes provisions for loss of sight and vision, sight, vision, hearing, and upper body impairments. That's why you see, is it on our signs? It's supposed to be on our sign. No, it's not, is it? Yeah, it is. So right below the room numbers, there's Braille. Now, I have no idea. I've never simulated vision impairment to know, could I find this placard somewhere? I have no idea. But it is kind of, they're all in there at a standard height, so it must be that if you're vision impaired, you know, stand there, put your arm up at shoulder height, and you should be able to find the sign with the numbers on it to be able to tell where you are. The basics of this are, you know, you think about a wheelchair as 2'6" by 48 inches. That's pretty much the minimum dimension you're gonna have to work with. When the person's in the wheelchair, they can reach about 4 feet out. And they can reach up. They can make a good turn. And I'll tell you, if we brought a wheelchair in here today, even though you guys are young and coordinated and have your full strength, I'll bet there wouldn't be three of you that could make a turn in a 60-inch circle. It takes a lot of practice. But when you live in the chair, you get really adept with it. Most people will need, you know, more than a 60-inch turning circle. But when you look at a set of plans and you see this dashed circle in the kitchen and the dashed circle in the toilet, and you look at the spec and you see, gee, the toilet is a wall-hung toilet, which means it's not supported by the floor. You look at that and you go, that's expensive. I can't buy that wall-hung toilet at Home Depot. I could buy a regular one at Home Depot. And you might say, well, let's make the substitution. That dotted line that goes underneath the toilet is basically the foot swing. And you see the wall-hung toilet in a lot of apartments or a lot of commercial installations. It takes more money because you have to beef up the wall to carry the toilet, and it's got a special carrier kit to cantilever it out from the wall. But the reason is so you can make that full turnaround inside the bathroom and get out. Reach is limited, 54 inches high, and can only get within about 9 inches of the ground. And reach out about 34 inches. That's where front controls on appliances and things like that makes a lot of sense. And that also controls where our elevator controls are, elevator buttons and things are. Out on the site, parking takes more space. So you see the parking width is a little bit bigger, 96 inches. And there's a really big area between the handicapped parking spaces, 5 feet. And that's mostly because the vans that are accessible will have some kind of ramp or elevator that'll come outside. And that you need that 60 inches. The other thing we have to make sure of is that if there's no curb stop out here in the parking lot, if they pull up and they're literally using the sidewalk edge as a curb to stop the wheels, we've got to make sure that after the car overhangs, there's at least 3 feet there. So I start to think about parking spaces, sidewalks next to parking, as a minimum of 5 feet. That's just how I think about it. And of course, the parking's got to be almost flat. I don't know if any of you parked in lots that have a big side slope, so when you push the uphill door open before you get your legs out, it comes down and smacks your legs. They're trying to avoid that. So they're saying really the slope in any direction in this parking space, 2%. And that'll keep the door from coming back in on somebody. You'll see the parking in a lot of different configurations, but almost always with that big space next to it. And that's what the big space is for. It's for the elevator to come out the side of the vehicle. And when you get to that transition between the sidewalk and the street, in America, a curb is a standard 6-inch high concrete element. So we got 6 inches of height difference we've got to make up. And they're saying that the slope there can't be any more than 1 in 10. So we've got to slope it all the way back. In Blacksburg, you find this a lot, where there's a slope for a driveway or something, but the curb right there is almost a 6-inch drop off right there. If you're walking along the outside of the street in any of the neighborhoods in Blacksburg on a Thursday or a Friday after kind of your weekend kind of celebration, you turn a lot of ankles falling off this thing, right? You want to be walking on the inside edge where there isn't a lot of grade change. Because as a person who reads while they walk, I'm walking on the inside because I've fallen off these things way too many times. So the ADA says you can only have that straight, that 6-inch drop right at the edge there, if this is all turf. That's grass. Around Blacksburg, it's all sidewalk right next to the street. In the Midwest, we've always got a strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street. Call it a berm. But they don't seem to have that here. I think it's because in the Midwest, we're always looking for places to pile snow. And here we just don't get that much snow, so we don't have to worry about a place to pile it. So when the sidewalk is running right next to the street, this little triangle here they call a flare, and that flare has to slope at 1 in 10, just like the ramp down does. So that's one set of numbers to remember for this. Sidewalk to street, all the slopes are 1 in 10, flare and the ramp itself. Now, I'll talk about ramps in a minute. Ramps are kind of expensive to build. They got to have handrails, they got to have landings, as well as having a specific grade. But the Americans with Disabilities Act knows that if you can just make the sidewalk not slope more than 1 foot in 20 feet, or 1 inch in 20 inches, that you won't need the handrails, and you won't need the landings. So a slope sidewalk is probably the most desirable way to approach getting the building connected to the parking. Excuse me. Because it's the least expensive thing to build. As a person, when we try to run these in wheelchairs, you know, even though there's theoretically no limit to how long the slope can be at 1 in 20, you get pretty wiped out after about 300 feet. About a football field without a break, you're pretty tired. And I tell you, if you'd like to try this for extra credit, check out a wheelchair from maybe Squires, take a group of people and take a little trip and photograph every obstacle along the way and record your perceptions. Write that up and give it to me as a report, and I can replace a quiz for that. But you should try it just to see what that's like. So the maximum slope, who's that? Maximum slope for a slope sidewalk is 1 in 20. Minimum width for that is 3 feet. You should really think 5 feet. If it's only 3 feet wide, you've got to provide a 5-foot square area every 200 feet in order to allow for passing. If you go up to the University of Virginia, they have a new college called Hereford College, I think it is. And they've got a ramp because the college is on the side of the mountain. So they have this ramp that goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to get down to where the dining hall is. But it's only 3 feet wide, and it's got brick walls, those red brick walls that UVA is known for on both sides. We were there photographing the architecture one day, and a person is in a wheelchair is going down and back and down and back, and a person in a wheelchair is going up and back and up and back, and they get to the middle, and they can't pass each other. There was absolutely no way that they could get past each other. One person had to go backwards back down in order to get out because it was like a cattle chute. So it wasn't in full compliance with this idea that says you got to have a passing zone every 200 feet. Sidewalks have to be flush, and this is the part where we come in. If we don't get the subgrade below sidewalks and street pavings compacted correctly, first time there's frost, what's going to happen to our sidewalk sections? There's going to be a little bit of heave or a little bit of settlement. We'll get that half inch. We'll get more than a half inch of differential. For us, a half inch is no big deal, right? If you've got those little wheels on the front of the wheelchair, it might as well be a 5-foot wall because you're not getting over it. If you're a young vet coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq, you'll just pop a wheelie and get over it. If you're a Korean War vet, you're not going to get over it because you don't pop wheelies now. You're 75 years old. So we got to watch that. That's us. Make sure the compaction is good. Minimum width of the ramp, 36 inches when we get to the sidewalk between the flares. And, of course, the flare in that adjustment zone at the sidewalk is 1 in 10. So you got two numbers to remember now, 1 in 10, that's where the sidewalk meets the street, and 1 in 20, that's your preferred mode of making accessibility, that's a slope sidewalk. So now we'll talk about the more expensive one. 1 in 12. A ramp, accessible ramp, is considered, it's a thing that's 1 in 12 sloped, which is kind of steep. When you start operating on it, you can't, as you're moving, you can't take a breath or you're going backwards at kind of a good clip. Ramps are used when a sloped walk just is impossible. So you see a lot of these as adjustments to the front of buildings where buildings were built 24 inches above grade. Or a slope of 1 in 16 is what's recommended by the Paralyzed Veterans of America. They say, yeah, you can survive 1 in 12, but 1 in 16 is much more comfortable as a slope. Whenever the elevation change is over a half inch, you got to have a ramp. So in theory, let's see, if we look at that reducer strip there at Danette's door, or at Treva's door, that reducer strip can't be more than a half inch, or we've got to make a ramp. Now, the people who make those rubber reducer strips, they know this, so that if we have, like, instead of having carpet in our offices, if we had a thick set tile, so a tile that's set in an inch of mortar and the tile is maybe a half inch, they make a bigger reducer strip to meet this requirement, a reducer strip that's basically a ramp. And they keep it under 6 inches because if it's over 6 inches long, we got to put handrails on that ramp, and that would be kind of crazy at a door, wouldn't it? So minimum width of 3 feet, but it takes about 60 inches wide to pass. The other thing about a ramp is it can't be infinitely long. Every 30 inches of rise, you got to have a flat spot, a landing of 60 inches. So now there's three numbers to remember, right? 1 in 10. Whenever you meet a street, 1 in 20, that's your preferred slope sidewalk, and 1 in 12, that's a ramp. The difference between ramps and sidewalks is they got to have landings every 30 inches, they got to have landings at the top and the bottom of the ramp, and the landings have to be at least as deep as the ramp is wide, but 60 inches is the minimum. So if you made a ramp that was 72 inches wide, how deep would the landing have to be? The ramp is 72 inches wide. 72. Right. Minimum is 60. If it changes directions, if the ramp makes a left turn at that point, you got to have at least a 5-foot square area at the bottom. And if it's more than 6 inches long, the ramp, you got to have handrails on the sides. The handrails themselves, like the handrails in the stair, they got to be fully graspable. Because these ramps won't just be used by people in wheelchair. They'll be used by people on crutches. They'll be used by people with canes. They'll be used by people with walkers. They'll also be used by people who are vision impaired. And that fully graspable means you can't just put a 1x12 there or a 2x12 there as a handrail because you can't get your hand around it. And the idea is that when you're falling, you can grab it easier. That's the idea. Handrails can't be mounted flush to a wall. They got to be an inch and a half out from the wall, again, just so that when you're falling, you can grab that thing. Like the stair, the handrail on the inside of a ramp is continuous. It's your guide. And like a stair, the handrail is 34 to 38 inches above the stair itself. When the university first started building plywood ramps and handrails, when this ADA Act came out, they became bike racks. People would lock their bikes to these ramps, to the handrails on the ramps, and the handlebars would always stick inside more. And the handlebars would go in, stick inside of the ramp, and he'd be stuck. Couldn't get out of the building, couldn't get home. So the university started to, one, make more bike racks, and I think they're still doing that, and two, they started getting aggressive and cutting the bikes off those racks that are off of the handicapped accessible ramps and confiscating them until somebody came and get them. So it's gotten a little better. That's looking at a ramp. In section, slope is 1 in 12. Landing at the bottom, landing at the top. It's got a full handrail. Handrail is 34 to 38 inches high. And it has an extension that goes past the top and the bottom, just like our stairs do, so that the vision impaired people can tell a ramp is coming and a ramp is ending. Stairs themselves are different. So when we looked at stairs according to the building code, they were a little bit narrower than this. But then remember I said the code had those weasel words in it that said, do this calculation, that's the width of the stairs, unless it's specified someplace else. And there is a chapter in the code book that talks about accessibility, and this is where it says, between the handrails, 48 inches. So between the handrails, 48 inches. So what's the dimension from the wall to the wall? So we got an inch and a half handrail, and the handrail is an inch and a half off the wall, so we got 3 inches there, got 3 inches there, so we got 48 plus 6, which is 54 inches wall to wall. Now the other thing they said was, I don't know if you remember the Brady Bunch TV show, Mike Brady's the architect, so they had this stairway in the living room where it was just pieces of oak that floated, had no closed riser in it, open riser stair. So it was open through here, very dramatic. But they realized that when you have an artificial limb, you're kind of dragging that limb up the face of this riser. If it's an open riser, you catch and trip. So the code has changed and said now no more open risers. The architects, of course, said, well, gee, we need that drama some places. And they said, well, you know, your designers, your creative people, think of a way. And the architects started putting glass here. And they started putting perforated stainless steel here, so they still get transparency. But when you pull up your artificial leg, it doesn't snag on that point and cause you to trip. And, of course, the artificial limbs get better and better all the time. And if my mom was younger, she might be bowling again. Who knows? Stairs, according to the ADA, are just like the stairs, the railings that we have for the code. So we've got railings on both sides. Inside railing is continuous. That's your guide when the stairway gets filled with smoke. And the outside railing has to extend 12 inches plus beyond the upper end of the stair run, plus the dimension of one tread. I guess if you go down the stairway, when you picked up your software at Torgerson Bridge, if you walk down that stairway, look at the handrail at the end, how that ends. That's a contemporary handrail. Meets the current code. So you'll see the stairways have this big extension down at the bottom and a loop. That basically is telling vision-impaired people that they're at the end. The handrail itself has to be graspable. So typically you see this inch and a half dowel That's a stairwell. But there are companies that make extruded polyurethane or polyethylene handrails or bronze or brass ones. And they don't have to be round. They just got to be so you can get your hand around it. That's all. Mostly so that when you're falling, you can grab for something. And it's really hard to grab the top of a 2x12. So when they remodel Cogle Hall, they closed that this year, the end of this year. They're going to renovate it. It'll be interesting to see if they replace, because Cogle's handrails right now are 2x12 pieces of oak. Nice pieces of wood, but you can't get your hand around it. And of course, it's also required that there be areas of rescue assistance. And if you took, you know, the building where they're doing that concrete block sculptures on top of it now, the one with the big pyramids on it, if you go in those stairs and go down, you'll go past these areas of rescue assistance. They're really just a little bit of a recess in the stair, kind of a bigger area in the stair, and it's got a communication panel next to it. So if you're there in a wheelchair, you push the button, and you can talk to the firefighters at the command center to say, "I'm here, I need somebody to come and get me." And they're about 30 by 48 inches. So when you're seniors and you're working with architecture students in a design build lab, you can hold them to this stuff. And you may know it better than them. If you see something that's wrong, any time in the process, you want to bring it up, because you know that if you go ahead and construct it, even though it was someone else's responsibility to design it, it's going to cause you a headache later on. It's going to cause you paperwork later on. So I think it's always better to help out the team rather than sit on something knowing that it's a mistake. Doors. Because the doors, the construction of the door includes, see this little piece of wood here, a stop, and then the way the hinge works, the thickness of the door, even when it's open, the thickness of the door is still kind of in the opening. It takes a 36-inch wide door, so this is a 3-0 door, to make a 32-inch clear opening through the doorway. Just the last number you got to remember is all doors are 3-0. This is a little bit tricky. If the door is going to open in, you need an area of about 5 feet, and you need about 2 feet on the, I guess it's the strike side, in order to wheel up, open the door, push it open, and then get in. And what kind of width do we need? We need about 48 inches. So right here, what are we? This is not quite a 2-foot ceiling tile. This is a full 2-foot ceiling tile. So are we in compliance right here? No. Our table is in that space, so they couldn't get into Kihong's door. How are we over there? Are we in compliance? Because we've got it one tile that's almost full. Here's a full tile, and the edge of the table is still a couple inches back. So here we're in compliance. Here we're out of compliance. When the door has to be pushed open, we need the same 12 inches on the strike side. And you can imagine this is kind of tricky to do if the door has a closer on it. Because you've got to unlock the door. You've got to push it. And then you've got to try to get through the opening before that hydraulic closer brings the door back on you, right? And that's something we have a lot to do with, because we're the people who make the final adjustments on those closers. We're the ones who torque those things down. Let me get to that. Yeah. So in a vestibule, and I guess you all know Johnson Center, where Burger King is. So it has two doors. It has the circular door, which doesn't count as an accessible entrance. And then it has that other little door that has the motorized operator. The distance in between, so in Johnson Center, the inside door swings in the direction of egress. The outside door swings in the direction of egress. So when you push the motorized button, you've got to get out of the way so that door can open. Then you can roll in, And in theory, there either is another button or this one is synchronized so that it opens next. When it opens, it has to leave you at least 4 feet from its open position to the back of the vestibule so you can get in. The motorized openers are really a great, great advantage. The real problem with them is they just don't last very long. They replace them probably about every 2 years on campus. So I think in some places on campus you'll see signs saying, if you don't need the motorized door opener, if you don't need the accessible door opener, open it yourself because it'll save us motor life. I've seen that at Newman Library where they don't want you to use it. But when your hands are full, or when it's cold and flu season and you're looking at that knob and you're thinking, how many germy people have touched that thing today? And I use the back of my hand and I hit that button almost every time because I don't want to touch that. Anyway, our elevator controls are set the same way, 54 inches to the highest point and 35 inches to the lowest point. When we did an exhibition, I was a curator at the National Building Museum. We did an exhibition on the history of wood construction in America. Opening night, there were 3 people who showed up in wheelchairs, different kinds of wheelchairs, 2 motorized and 1 manual. And they were just there. They were advocates for the Paralyzed Veterans of America. They just came to make sure that we did everything right. So they went up to every exhibit and made sure that the exhibit wasn't too high, that they couldn't see it, that the cards were low enough, that there was Braille next to the card, so if they were vision impaired, they could get it. And that's generally the higher profile project you're on, the more scrutiny you're going to get on these things, on compliance. The designers are supposed to put all this stuff in the contract documents. You just have to be alert to the follow-through. It's almost impossible to buy an elevator today that isn't accessible. Every elevator manufacturer, anything they sell, is going to meet the ADA guidelines. When you go into a remodeling, that's when you're going to find stuff that won't meet it. But most of the time, those old elevators, just like when you go into a building to remodel, you're going to find an electrical panel board from 1920. Most of those systems are going to have to be taken out and put in new anyways. So you won't have to rehab it. But their rules are basically 54 inches of inside depth, 36 inches of door opening. When you get into the toilets, you're really just thinking 5 feet is your dimension for width, and you're trying to maintain that 32-inch door opening. That's why the handicap stall is always the biggest one. It turns out to be really good in an airport when you want to get your bags in there with you. Handicap bathroom, you can pretty much get in the same footprint that you can get a normal tub, toilet, lav. Your designer should be able to make it work. You just have to be a little thoughtful about it. You're not going to get the double lav and the whirlpool bath in that dimension. But I wanted to make sure you had some of these things. I'll pull some of the extra credits off of this section. And if you're looking for a pocket guide, this little guide here is the Americans with Disabilities Act Accessibility Guidelines. So it's called the ADA-AG. And it's filled with numbers and diagrams. Most of the diagrams that you saw today were scanned out of there. And that's available from any online book dealer for not much money. So if you're looking to build your reference library, that's about all you'd need to have, and you can cover everything. So.